Now we're coming to sermon number 24 in our walk through the Old Testament. Can you believe it? We've had a whole lot of staff changes since the series began. Now number 24, we're very nearly at the end. We look at the book of Esther in the Old Testament, where our reading was. Page 436 is where we are. The book of Esther. The reluctant representative is what we're calling this little study. It's an interesting feature of this book of Esther that the name of God doesn't feature in it once. It's meant that in very early days some people queried whether it should be in the Bible at all. But then one of the criteria that has always been applied by God's people as to whether a particular book can be recognized as being truly inspired by God and be part of the Bible is the effect that it has on successive generations of believing people. On that count alone, as well as others, Esther has always been accepted as a God-given, God-inspired part of that section of the Old Testament known as the Writings. Chronologically, it should come at the very end of the Old Testament, and this is why, apart from next Sunday's summing up sermon, which concludes our walk through the Old Testament, the book of Esther occurs in the middle of the Old Testament here, because the books tend to be placed in their different categories of presentation: the law, the prophets, and here are the writings, including Esther, Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon. So we end, virtually, our walk through the Old Testament with a thriller. Oh, it is a thriller, this book. But let's put it, to begin with, in its historical setting. And don't worry too much if you are one of these people who takes notes. Don't worry too much about taking notes, unless you simply want to bang down my five main headings. Because this is a story, a true story, which still makes Jewish people sizzle all over with excitement as they read the book of Esther at their Feast of Purim, which in fact was only just about a week ago. Keep your Bibles open then at page 436 and around there. We're going to go all over the book of Esther. Every now and then I'll say a verse, look at it. Keep your Bible open somewhere around there. And let's recapitulate, first of all, on the history. Let's start with our text. Esther 4, verse... It's going to be verse... halfway through verse 14. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Now the history bit. 586 BC was the low watermark in Israel's fortunes as Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, swept upon Jerusalem and annihilated it. God's judgment, long foretold, had finally come upon his own people, and a period of captivity, exile, began for them. Even then, God watched over his people. He trained and educated them and used them. If you think of the story of Daniel and his companions, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Some years after all this, 539, Persia bursts upon the world stage with the capture of Babylon by Cyrus, king of Persia. Cyrus had no quarrel with the exiled Jews, so he gave them permission to go back to their own land. Remember Ezra, Nehemiah, those books we've been looking at recently. Thousands took advantage of that wonderful opportunity and left the land of their exile with thankfulness. So Esther comes around the same sort of period as Ezra and Nehemiah. Now, a surprising number of people did not go back to their land, their own land. Perhaps some feared the rigors of the journey. Others had already become adapted to their way of life during captivity. Some had been born there, of course, in captivity, and had settled and become comfortable. And some, of course, were doing trade and other things. And they'd got a new home, really. Of the many who decided to stay put, mention must be made of two. First, Mordecai, who had an appointment at court in Shushan, or Susa, the capital. We read about him in chapter 3, verse 5. There was also a young orphan girl who went by the intriguing name of Myrtle. Hadassah, in fact, was her Jewish name, which simply means Myrtle, otherwise known as Esther, which may be the Persian name for star. Call her what you will, she was Mordecai's young cousin. And because she was an orphan, she was brought up by Mordecai himself, virtually as his daughter. Other characters in this story include, of course, Xerxes, king of Persia for about 20 years. He's the Ahasuerus of our story, a greedy tyrant to whom the lives of his subjects hardly mattered a button. At the beginning of this story, his queen was Vashti. Beautiful as she probably was, she was really more like a pet budgerigar than a queen, because she was shut away for a great deal of the time, as the custom, I'm afraid, was in those days. Who else is there in this epic? Haman, a miserable specimen, the king's favorite, the villain of the piece, not a real person, but an Amalekite, and therefore a deadly foe of all Jews. He'd climbed, crawled, talked his way to the top, until here he is, a statesman and right-hand man, second only in the land to the king of Persia himself, Ahasuerus. And the story opens in 536 BC, the third year of Xerxes' reign, with a glittering dinner party. It must have been quite an affair for the governors of all Persia's 127 provinces to be invited, and that meant some of them would have travelled half across the known world to get there. India, Ethiopia, in all likelihood, were represented at this dazzling feast. And here in the magnificence of the palace treasures, and occupying the centre of the stage, is the despot Ahasuerus, Xerxes himself, the most powerful man of his day, the monarch who wasted his power. And then in the feast, Ahasuerus got drunk. Verses 10 and 11 of chapter 1 recall the crazy thing he decided to do under the influence. He decided to show off Queen Vashti in public and enjoy the sensation that she'd create as she glided into the imperial reception, arrayed in the latest Vivian Westwood design. Then the royal deputation was sent to fetch her from her wing in the palace, and it met with a pretty frosty reception. Well, as any decent woman would, Vashti tossed her head and elected to stay put rather than show herself off to a room full of drunken men. So when the flattened flunkies, or whatever they were, got back to the banquet hall, the king, of course, were wobbly. He asked his advisers what he should do, and they said, in effect, chapter 1, verse 17, this is really the Bew's revised version, they said, "It's a bad day, my lord, for the noble male. This incident is going to go public. It's bad for morale. It's bad for the empire," is what they were saying. "The queen is going to have to be ditched. And we have to teach a bit of respect around these parts." So it was a very male chauvinist reaction. And that's how Vashti came to be banished from the palace. So there was a vacancy. A new queen had to be found, and chapter 2 opens with the, I think, the only beauty contest that is recorded in the whole of the Bible. All the time, you mustn't forget, the young girl Myrtle had been growing up. And this is where the first impossible thing happened in the story. Myrtle featured in the beauty contest. Not that that was impossible. Myrtle, it seems, was quite a knockout. What was remarkable was that God's providence can even take account of and accommodate a Miss World contest, or a Miss Persia contest, as in this case. Chapter 2 and verses 15 and 16 record the result. Myrtle gets Vashti's job. Everyone views her with favor. The king is delighted with her. A banquet is thrown for her. And there is Queen Myrtle, though I think we better call her Esther from now on, the queen who was wedded to power. And that was the first impossible thing. Esther, a Jew, as queen of Persia. Mordecai knew about her ancestry, of course, but nobody else did. And Mordecai was determined to keep it that way, keep it a secret. So Esther wore the regal crown and attended banquets in her honor. Chapter 2, verse 18. The flags were put out. Income tax, we read, went down to zero that year. Everybody had a big splash. And a best-kept secret in Persia remained a secret. So this isn't only the story of the monarch who wasted his power. It's the thriller of the Jewish queen who was wedded to power. And God doesn't forget his people. Little did the Jews in Persia know of the trials that awaited them, but God knew. And he puts Esther on the throne of Persia, and thus gives Mordecai, his servant, a vital link with the king. So we remember that, we hold it in our memories. Of course, no one's life was secure in Persia, not even Xerxes. Inevitably, an assassination plot is hatched, because cut off from reality, surrounded by stooges and yes-men, the king's life was anything but secure. Chapter 2, verse 21 tells us of some characters called Bigthan and Teresh. They were the king's minders. They were the security checks. They decide on an assassination plot. And the thing goes wrong from the start. There was a leak. Somebody blabbed. And eventually Mordecai, who always had his ear close to the ground, got wind of the plot, and he sends word to Esther. And Esther gets the news to Ahasuerus, and the would-be assassins are arrested, tried, and summarily executed. And the matter is recorded in the history book of the king's reign, that Ahasuerus had commissioned somebody or other to write. The volume is stuck away on a shelf or put away in a vault, and a week or two later, everybody had forgotten the matter. But the incident shows that Mordecai was a faithful servant to the king. Well, you say, what about these trials that the Jews were to pass through? Well, on to the next episode, and here enters the villain, Haman, the statesman who lusted for power. Chapter 3, verse 1, shows us that he was already in a very powerful position indeed, second only to the king, and then the absurd command goes out in verse 2, that one and all are to bow down and grovel in adoration before Haman whenever he's around the place. Mordecai just could not bring himself to do it. And so, of course, stands out like a sore thumb. Haman didn't seem to have noticed, but plenty of others did. And of course, as you can well imagine, somebody had to go and tell Haman. You know who won't bow down to you, don't you, Haman? Mordecai. Oh, and Haman, he's a Jew. So now it was Haman's turn to throw a wobbly. Being an Amalekite, he was hardly a friend of the Jews at the best of times. And when Mordecai refused to bow down and be a nobody just like everybody else, he represented a somebody who had to be crushed. Hitler was to try the same game on a grander scale in a later generation. And Haman, in chapter 3, verse 6, in his resulting plan to wipe out Mordecai and the people that he represented, just stands in a line of successive persecutors of God's ancient people. After casting lots to find out what his lucky month was to be, Haman settles for the 13th day of the month of Adar. And he persuades the pathetic king to decree that all Jewish people in the realm be wiped out on that day. Couriers are dispatched in every direction, chapter 3 verse 15 tells us, while the king and Haman celebrate over a bottle. Once, of course, the decree became fixed, it was then the law of the Medes and Persians, and it couldn't be revoked. It had to be carried through. It's an absolute crackpot kind of law. But there it was. Nothing now could save the Jews. But now we turn the spotlight onto yet another character, Mordecai, the servant who utilized power. It was impossible for him to get near to Esther now that she was queen, so he does the next best thing, which is to attract her attention through the girls who waited on her. Consequently, first few verses of chapter 4 relate this. Esther's maid say to her one day, "There's an extraordinary fellow at the front gate, Your Majesty, jumping around in sackcloth and ripping his shirt to pieces, shampooing his head with ashes, wailing aloud." And somehow, well, the Queen puts on her thinking cap and she works it out. It could be Mordecai. And so she begins to make contact with him, sends out eventually Hatak, one of the few palace servants she could trust. And Mordecai tells him the whole story of Haman's hatred and crafty scheme, of the edict, of the impending fate of the Jews. He sends word through Hatak to Esther, telling her to use her position to plead before the king. And Esther is absolutely scared out of her boots. She sends back word saying something about how inaccessible the king is, chapter 4, verse 11, and how that you go into the king's presence at your own risk, because he was that kind of a man. And if you simply burst in without being called, you're for the chopper. Unless he chooses to extend his scepter towards you and grant you his favour, but then what are the odds that he won't? Mordecai thinks it over and sends back a crisp message, verse 13. Don't think, he says, that just because you're in the palace, you'll escape this massacre. If you don't do your little bit right now, deliverance will come for the Jews all right, but it'll come from another quarter, and you and your father's house will perish. Fine way to talk to your cousin. Then comes Mordecai's punchline, and it's the verse we started with. Verse 14, second part. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this? You can see what he's saying, can't you? Don't you understand, Esther, that the only reason why you've been allowed to come to the throne, the only reason why you've been wedded to power, is for this moment, so pull yourself together. Go and see the king. Plead for your people. Who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this? This was the moment. It's the art of seeing God's moment when it's come. And Esther and her people are there in limbo, out in Persia, a reduced people, with little real room for maneuver and action and leadership. They were in a sort of in-between position in life. And it's Mordecai who has the faith to see that yes, God is in that empty situation too. And God is in that moment of danger. And friends, if we can hold on faithfully to what we believe is God's loving direction and plan for our lives, when nothing dramatic is happening to you, when that answer to prayer still seems a million miles away, can we not believe that God is still just as active 5 minutes before the breakthrough as he is 5 minutes after, when of course it's very easy then to say, oh praise God, he heard. When that desirable job refuses to come our way, we're called upon, it seems, to hold on. I'm going to go on growing, and I'll stay close to him, holding on in faith and obedience in those dull in-between periods of life. We're going to be rewarded. We shall grow in those times. They are the growing periods, not the moments of high achievement, the exciting spots. It's the in-between times and how we deal with those that makes you and me into the kind of people we're going to turn out to be. We hold on to that. Who knows whether you've not come to the kingdom for such a time as this? And he discerns that a moment has come. Mordecai is a faithful servant who utilized power. In fact, he wasn't even in the position of power, but he was able to prod the person who was. Until finally, Esther in verse 15 and 16 of chapter 4 says, all right, I'll go. On condition, of course, that every Jew who can be found starts to pray for that moment of truth when I must stand before the king. And the big suspense bit comes in chapter 5. Esther walks into the king's court, holds her breath, and breathes again as the king's scepter is held out towards her. So here's her opportunity, and the king says, verse 3, what is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given you, even to the half of my kingdom. So what would you have done? This is it, see? What would you have said? Would you have dropped on one knee and then said, then, Your Majesty, please save my people. We are all going to be murdered because of your new decree. You have it in your power to do something. Esther didn't say that at all. She simply said, Your Majesty, would you like to come to dinner tonight? And would you like to bring friend Haman? She certainly had her head screwed on. Let's get the king into a decent mood before we start trying to influence him. It's a long-term operation. And so Xerxes smiles and says, anything you like, darling. Haman and he arrived on the tick, and dinner was served, and they were just coming to the cheese and biscuits when the king says, now what's it all about? Verse 6, what is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom it shall be fulfilled. What would you have said at that point? I think I would brought in my plea at that point. Esther didn't. I don't know why she said what she said. It's a puzzle to me. In verse 8, perhaps she was playing it extra craftily, or maybe she just lost her nerves. dinner at, she said, "Would you both like to come to dinner again tomorrow?" I think she lost her nerve, perhaps, and overdid it. I don't know what it was, but it didn't seem to matter too much, because Haman was fairly purring as he went back later on and reflected on how much Esther must think of him. But he had one niggling complaint. Look at the end of verse 12. He says to his wife and to others, "And tomorrow also I am invited by her, together with the king. Yet all this does me no good as long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate." It still niggles him. And Haman's wife has some soft words of comforting, wifely advice for him in verse 14. "Build a gallows 50 cubits high for Mordecai. And tomorrow morning tell the king to hang him on it." Sweet little creature. So Mordecai's fate seems fixed, and all that night a crash program of gallows building was going on in Haman's back garden ready for the morning. But then the next impossible thing happens. I love it. Chapter 5 closes with the gallows made and Haman chirping off to sleep very, very happily. Chapter 6 opens with this simple statement: on that night the king could not sleep. The book of Esther is an account of God's providence. On that night, of all nights, it just happened. No sleep. Poor Xerxes. What do you do when you can't sleep? Everyone has their remedy. Perhaps you get up and have a drink of water? Get the latest opinion poll news from the radio? Read a Frederick Forsyth novel? Or do you just lie quietly and miserably, count sheep? Well, Xerxes had an infallible method. He would read history books. Verse 1. "On that night the king could not sleep, and he gave orders to bring the book of memorable deeds, the chronicles, and they were read before the king." So you see, no Frederick Forsyth when it's a case of insomnia, because that would be too exciting. But a history book should do the trick all right. So they dig out the history book. They open it up, they get it off the shelf, they start reading the record of the king's reign, they cover the memorable deeds, the worthy achievements, the laws, the edicts, the building programs, and whatnot. It is all incredibly abstruse and dull. And Ahasuerus is beginning to nod off. And then there's just the tiny flicker of interest as they read from the history the account of the attempted assassination of the king Ahasuerus, and of how Bigthan and Teresh, the two conspirators, were found out in that treasonable attempt, and how it was Mordecai who had leaked the news and unmasked the criminals. By now it is getting very interesting. It reads on and on. It's too late to sleep, and in fact dawn is just about breaking. The light is beginning to filter into the king's bedroom, and in verse 3, Ahasuerus, stifling a yawn, inquires, "And so, how did we reward Mordecai for his faithful service in this episode?" And the answer comes back: nothing has been done for him. At that exact moment, we learn, Haman is observed in the courtyard outside. You and I know very well why his tum at the crack of dawn, the gallows is built and ready. But the king doesn't know that. And he says, "Haman is there? Throw him in." This is a book about God's providence. As Haman walks into the royal bedroom, his mind is full of Mordecai and the gallows, and he cannot wait to unfold his plan to the king. The king's mind at that point is also just then full of Mordecai, for he's just been hearing the account of how he saved the king's life. Neither knows what the other is thinking about. Haman is dying to get his spiel in first of all, but of course the king has the right to open up first. "Oh, Haman," he says, sitting up in bed in his pajamas. "So what should be done?" he says. "What should be done for the man whom the king delights to honor?" There it is in verse 6. "What should be done for the man whom the king delights to honor?" You actually feel a bit sorry for Haman with this particular banana skin. A little voice inside him says, "Here you are, lad. Another leg up for you, but don't make it too obvious." So Haman opens his mouth and starts his reply. "The man whom the king delights to honor? Verses 7, 8, and 9 list his suggestions. Royal robes, royal horse to sit on, the royal crown on his head, deck him up to the skies, take him through the streets for a public parade, heralded everywhere by the words, "Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honour." Well, of course, you can see it coming a mile off. It's all going to happen to dear Mordecai. And give him the full works, Ahasuerus tells Haman. Don't forget a single detail of that list. Give him the lot. Royal robes, horse crown, ticker tape reception, heralds, everything. I cannot think that Mordecai enjoyed it very much. It must have been terribly bewildering. And I can imagine him hurrying straight back afterwards to an early bed after a light supper of scrambled eggs. But Haman, he's dizzy with rage and frustration. And his wife can see the writing on the wall. And then what happens? Banquet number two, of course. The hours have passed by. Esther is throwing this banquet. It takes place in chapter 7. The same stage in the meal. Ahasuerus repeats his offer. "What is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you." And this time the queen really does plead for her life and the lives of her people, the Jews. In fact, the king is staggered by her passionate outburst. He asks, "But who is the snake from whom such a wicked plan originated?" And Esther sits up and looks straight into the shifty gaze of Haman and denounces him, a foe and an enemy, this wicked Haman. When they read this at the Feast of Purim in the Jewish synagogues, they're reading it, I suppose, about a week ago. Every time the word Haman is mentioned, it's a bit like a pantomime. They hiss and they boo the name of Haman. Well, the terror that engulfs Haman is matched only by the overpowering fury that sweeps over the king, who has to go into the garden to cool off. When he returns, Haman then begins to plead for his life, and at that point some mischievous chamberlain speaks up, chapter 7, verse 9. There are always such people with their twisted sense of humour, probably gazing up at the ceiling, he innocently remarks, "Haman's got a smashing new gallows in his back garden. I passed it only this morning." It delights the Jews. Well, of course, that was the end of Haman. Poetic justice, you might say. What has happened now? Why, the next impossible thing has happened. Mordecai has got into power. You can read about it in chapter 8, verse 2. He is in power. So you say then, Mr. Preacher, all is well that ends well. Well, not quite. Do you remember one snag? The law of the Medes and Persians, which can never be revoked. That edict authorizing the annihilation of the Jews. It is a problem. All problems can be solved if a despot has the desire to overcome them. It was finally solved by the passing of another edict and by another big send-out of letters, verse 11. "By these the king allowed the Jews who were in every city to gather and defend their lives, to destroy, to slay and annihilate any armed force of any people or province that might attack them." Not that that would make much difference. I suppose the Jews would have tried to defend themselves anyway. But now that they were allowed to do so by a royal edict, commanded to do so, it was immediately apparent which way the royal sympathies were moving. All of a sudden the sting had gone out of the first edict. Not saying there wasn't an attempt to carry out the massacre, but clearly they weren't going to try too hard. And no doubt a lot of the troops would go rather slowly or turn up late. Bloodshed there certainly was, but nothing to what would have happened otherwise. So look at chapter 8, verse 17. "And in every province and in every city, wherever the king's command and his edict came, there was gladness and joy among the Jews, a feast and a holiday. And many of the peoples of the country declared themselves Jews, for the fear of the Jews had fallen upon them." So it was a U-turn with a vengeance. All of a sudden the Jews had become popular, and people were rushing round to Somerset House or its equivalent, digging up their family trees and trying to prove that perhaps they were Jews after all. It's an extraordinary drama. This is the story of a sort of power struggle, but what does it tell us? Why, it tells us that in and through the events of human history, there is a God who cares and who is interested enough to act and to guide. He's the God of providence, intervening, involved with nations and individuals alike. The whole story is very important to our philosophy today. Are we the victims of blind mechanistic forces? Or does someone in control know what's happening in Russia today, in North Korea, where Billy Graham has gone this very week for the first time any preacher from the West, any preacher from anywhere, has got into Korea to preach to North Korea this next week? Or the future political map of this country, does God care? Can he overturn the decisions of wicked or unprincipled people like Haman or your boss or that intractable immigration officer who's making things so difficult for somebody? We ask ourselves, does God rule? When again and again the banner headlines will say he's not ruling, no one's in control, it's chaos out there, or in an in-between period where it's dull and boring. This episode reminds us, no, there is somebody. And when we're making decisions that will affect our future, is it worth involving God at such a time as this? The book of Esther assures us that it is. So we thought of the queen who was wedded to power. We consider the monarch who wasted his power. We've been warned by the statesman who lusted for power. We've learned from the servant who utilized power. But it's most important of all, I suggest to you, but underneath and behind all the activities and the intrigues and anxieties of these characters and peoples was the hand that wielded the power, God's hand. Yes, as I said at the beginning, read right through Esther, God is never mentioned. But we read between the lines in this story of unexpected reversal. Then we can discern the hand of God, the God who overrules mistakes and sins, the God who really has the monopoly of power in the end, in this world of ours. Who knows whether you've not come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Surprisingly, God has his plan for life and the future, even when fortunes are low, even when things are going badly for somebody and the tide is out. Those times God is happy to use. And the art of living and succeeding is to a large extent the art of recognizing God's moment. We have to learn this art patiently, we who are in the fellowship of the in-betweens. And such people have every reason to do as our heroine Esther did, and spend their lives for a cause that is bigger and wider than any earthly kingdom. We conclude the walk through the Old Testament with a summary sermon next week.